I was arrested once by the Israeli soldiers. They kidnapped me, not arrested me. They kidnapped me from the house and they took me to an empty area to scare me, terrify me. They wanted to do something bad to me, to beat me up or to do something further. I didn't know. You know how I escaped from them? I looked to the one of the windows of Palestinian homes and I told, you know, it was false, not true. Film me, please, film me. They are attacking me. The soldier said, camera.
Isa Amro was able to go home unscathed and relatively unharmed by the Israeli soldiers.
They are afraid of camera and they don't want themselves to be seen bad in the international community. So they don't want our stories to go out. And that's why they are going after me, because they see me as the father of documentation in the West Bank and the one who gave the Palestinians the tool to really affect the Israeli false PR against the Palestinians.
This is Finding Humanity, and I'm your host, Hizami Bermada. Through personal stories of courage and purpose, our podcast puts a human face on the most critical issues facing our world. In each episode, we aim to educate and inspire you to take action, and together to help create a better world. Stay tuned for a special thought leadership segment with Hina Gilani at the end of this episode. The segment is brought to you through our partnership with the Elders, an independent group of global leaders brought together by Nelson Mandela. Isa Amro wanted nothing to do with politics when he was 14 years old.
I wanted to do my dream, to be a very good student and to study hard and to fulfill my dream to be a professor. That was my main goal in my life. Study, study, study. I was one of the best students in my school.
He also loved playing soccer and was fond of riding his bike into the crowded streets.
You know, we had near our house fruit market and especially the banana storage market. So I used to escape from my mother to go to the banana storage to eat banana. I love banana. And I was a child, I was eating a lot of banana.
Isa was one of seven children. All his life, he lived in a city called Hebron in the West Bank. The West Bank is the name of the Palestinian territory sandwiched between Israel and Jordan. It is home to nearly 3 million Palestinians. Although the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is complex and difficult to unpack in a short podcast, I'll provide some context as it relates to understanding Isa's story. Until World War I, Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire for four centuries. For most of this period, the Jewish population represented 3% of the total, with Muslims representing the largest segment of the population, and Christians the second. When World War I ended, the British took control of Palestine and announced the support of the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. This document was called the Balfour Declaration. Over the next 25 years, Palestine saw an influx of Jewish immigration from Europe, peaking in the 1930s with the Nazi persecution of Jews in Europe. Demands for Palestinian independence and the fear of the expansion of the Zionist agenda led to violent episodes between Arab and Jewish populations and a significant British military presence in the region. Due to escalating tensions, the United Kingdom announced its intention to terminate its mandate for Palestine and asked the United Nations to solve the problem of Palestine.
The key date, of course, is 1947. That's when the United Nations decided to partition the territory into a Jewish state and to an Arab state.
That's Omar Shakir, Israel and Palestine director for Human Rights Watch. Omar is referencing the United Nations partition plan for Palestine that was adopted in November 1947. The resolution recommended the creation of independent Arab and Jewish states and a special international regime for the city of Jerusalem. The plan, however, had no implementation power, and in May 1948, on the eve of Britain's withdrawal from Palestine, the State of Israel was born.
So it led to a result where the Jewish forces took over a much larger portion of the territory and expelled about over 700,000 Palestinians who lived in the territory, as well as destroying over 400 Palestinian villages.
Around 85% of the Palestinian Arab population fled or were expelled from their homes. Palestinians refer to this moment as the Nakba, or the catastrophe.
Israelis mark that as the foundation of their state. I should note that for the 20 years from 1948-49 to 1967, you had a situation in which Jordan largely managed the West Bank, Egypt, the Gaza Strip. Within Israel proper, the Palestinians who were not expelled or forced to flee in 1948, they were administered under an Israeli military regime that was in place until December 1966.
The expansion of the State of Israel continued. And in 1967, during what was called the Six-Day War, Israel occupied the Palestinian territories of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank through a bloody conflict. This resulted in expelling around 35,000 Palestinians, destroying many Palestinian villages, and expanding the Zionist Jewish settler presence into the Palestinian territories. This included the city of Hebron, where Isa lived.
They did this in sort of a trickery.
That's Avner Gvaryahu, executive director of the organization Breaking the Silence.
It wasn't officially backed by the state, but very quickly the state sort of gave him coverage. And in April 1968, we have the first settlers entering Hebron and basically settle in a hotel called the Park Hotel. And they actually coined the phrase settlers in a letter that they send to officials in the government, basically saying, we're here and we're here to stay, signed by the settlers of Hebron.
The number grew from 80 settlers in 1968 to more than 750,000 settlers in 2020. Jewish settlements in the West Bank are illegal under international law.
I mean, the Israeli government has, you know, virtually every day for 53 years been building settlements in the OPT. That's a war crime. It's a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention.
That's Omar again. He's referring to the Fourth Geneva Convention, which is an international treaty agreed upon by 196 countries, including Israel. The Fourth Geneva Convention notes that, quote, states that occupy other territories are not allowed to transfer parts of their own civilian populations to these occupied territories, end quote. Palestinian residents consider settlements extremely problematic.
So the Israeli settlers who are living in Hebron, they feel that they have supremacy over us.
That's Isa again.
They don't see me as an equal human being to them. Imagine that you live in a city. One group, they have their own legal system where they have everything. They have welfare life. They have impunity. They are not accountable according to that legal system. On the other hand, Palestinians are below them legally, and we are completely suppressed and oppressed by them. They have guns. They have everything. We are under the Israeli military law. In the military law, I'm not allowed for any kind of peaceful protesting. I don't have any kind of freedom, no freedom of speech, no freedom of movement, no freedom of opinion or religion. All my rights were violated.
Isa never wanted to be an activist. In the early 2000s, Isa was studying engineering at the Polytechnic University. And in 2003, in the final year of his five-year program, he was robbed of his dream of becoming an engineer.
At once, the occupation came to the university, closed the campus out of nowhere, and they said, you are not allowed anymore to come to the university. We don't want any gathering here. It's illegal. I went back home crying because of that. I was broken. I didn't know what to do.
This pivotal moment led Isa to research the term revolution online.
I wanted to make a revolution to get my degree. It was about getting my university degree, my engineering degree. It was not about ending the occupation. Fortunately, what Yahoo gave me was to study about Martin Luther King.
Of the freedom of speech, somewhere I read. Of the freedom of press.
About Gandhi.
I regard myself as a soldier of peace. It is complete independence that we want.
About the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. So I studied a lot how to make a real mobilization for the students to protest and to do awareness, to do advocacy.
This was the beginning of Issa's long journey as a human rights defender and a leader of nonviolent activist groups.
2007, I was volunteering with many human rights organizations, with international groups. I told myself, we should work to recruit Palestinians to nonviolence resistance and start with youth.
His organization is called Youth Against Settlements.
We agreed that we start recruiting youth age from 15 and go on to go to the schools, to go to the universities and talk to the students to join our struggle. And we do a lot of documentation. So in documentation, we give out cameras to the families to document the human rights violations by the settlers or by the army, to document their life by using the video camera. And we use that materials for media, for legal purposes, or for archiving.
Issa says that they contact journalists with the hopes that mainstream media will cover the stories of Palestinians from their own lenses.
In media, and especially in the international media, we were described as terrorists. How come a Palestinian who is attacked by Israeli settlers or, being beaten is a terrorist, and they are the victims after attacking us too? So we, in 2006, decided to document the Israeli human rights violations. And we started distributing cameras to the Palestinian houses and to the Palestinian families.
Issa shares that in the beginning, these families refused to take cameras because they feared for their lives.
I convinced them in a way or another. I told them it's a weapon. It's the most trustful witness in that we will do advocacy. We will protect you. And the first film, which came out, got a lot of media attention. And on the other hand, we were lucky that it was the beginning of using the social media in Palestine. So people, in one hand, document the human rights violations, get a legal record. In the other hand, they saw themselves in the media as people being attacked by the Israeli settlers. And we managed to affect public opinion in Palestine. And the camera became from a personal ideology to a culture.
Avner, one of our experts whom you heard from earlier, is an Israeli veteran soldier. His organization, Breaking the Silence, is an Israeli non-government organization established by veteran soldiers of the Israeli Defense Forces. They have taken it upon themselves to expose the Israeli public and the international community to the realities of everyday life in the occupied Palestinian territories, or OPT, aiming to bring an end to the occupation. The term apartheid is used to describe what's happening by, some international bodies. There's a lot of resistance to use that term. I'd be curious to know, do you consider what's happening in Hebron as an apartheid?
I think it's clear that there is a de facto apartheid reality in Hebron. I mean, two separate systems governed under one regime for two populations living in this one territory. We can go on sort of, the definition of what institutes the law of apartheid. I'm not a legal scholar, but it's very clear that this separation policy is occurring on the ground.
Apartheid is the Afrikaans word for apartness, originally used to describe the system of racial discrimination that existed in South Africa until 1994. Apartheid is one of the many crimes against humanity set out in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. It is defined by the United Nations International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crimes of Apartheid as inhumane acts committed in the context of an institutionalized regime of systemic oppression and domination by one racial group over any other racial group or groups, and committed with the intention of maintaining that regime.
I don't think that Israel or the Israeli society is unique in turning a blind eye to difficult truths. I think that silence is not an Israeli epidemic or an Israeli disease, right? Every society has its silences, and I think Israel in that sense is no different. I do think where we are different or unique is where, on the one hand, we are seen as a Western democracy that receives, you know, connections and the privilege of a Western democracy. But on the other hand, we're maintaining a military dictatorship in our backyard. That is just the truth. It's not that Israelis don't know at this point. I think many don't know the details, but there are so many excuses and so many silencing mechanisms and so many ways to really turn this blind eye that we really see our job as sort of forcing the beam of light onto these stories.
Stories like the one Issa is sharing, which tells the grim reality that he continues to live in.
They say everything possible to make me feel nervous or provoked or even, you know, uncomfortable with my presence in that area. For example, saying bad things about Prophet Muhammad, saying bad things about my mother, saying bad thing about my sisters, saying bad words about my friends.
Speaking up against Israeli authorities could lead to arrest. Human Rights Watch notes that civilians can be jailed for up to 10 years for attending a political gathering with more than 10 people, or for displaying flags or political symbols without army approval. Israeli military orders ban 411 organizations, including every major political movement.
To be arrested, it's a big deal. It's not a normal arrest. It's, you know, between 4 days to 8 days in the military detention center with very, very bad treatment, with very bad, you know, words and disrespect and affecting your dignity.
In September 2017, the Hebron District Court charged Issa with disruption of public order, insulting the authorities, and inciting strife.
I am indicted by 16 military charges for being a peaceful human rights defender in my own city, trying to defend my people's rights and try to advocate for peaceful non-violence resistance against the Israeli occupation.
As of January 6, 2021, Issa was convicted by an Israeli military court related to his activism in the occupied West Bank, including in his hometown of Hebron. To better understand the outcry of Palestinians like Issa, I asked Omar Shakir to shed some light on the human rights violations that were taking place.
The main human rights issue when you're talking about the situation in Israel and Palestine pertains to Israel's rule over Palestinian oppression of Palestinians. That takes different forms with different degrees of intensity. You know, in the Gaza Strip, you have a situation where the Israeli army has maintained for 13 years a closure of the territory, a generalized ban on the movement of people and goods. So basically, you know, Israeli policy has turned Gaza into an open air prison. This is a generalized ban on the movement of people. It's not a case where it's particular people who pose a security threat. It's everybody unless you fall within exemptions.
Ahmad explains that the restrictions of movement exists even within the occupied Palestinian territories.
In the West Bank, I mean, you really have a situation in which you have Jewish Israeli settlers and Palestinians who live in the exact same territory with completely different, you know, sets of rights, where the Israeli settlers are governed under Israeli civil law, enjoy full freedom of movement into East Jerusalem, into Israel, are citizens of Israel, vote in Israeli elections, and have preferential access to land, to water, to abilities to build. Well, where Palestinians in that territory have virtually none of those rights. Even though their lives are governed by Israel, they do not have any meaningful say in Israeli policy. They're not citizens of Israel.
Ahmad gave me a laundry list of violations, which he says are all under the framework of the discriminatory two-tiered system.
Why the Israeli settlers who are attacking us are not accountable and they have full impunity in the Israeli legal system and they don't see any consequences for attacking Palestinians? Israel is trying to take more land. It's about the land. It's not about protection. It's not about security. Security is a mutual concept. I need security. I should feel safe as everybody else should feel safe. I'm a human and, you know, human, they have feelings. And they have needs. I see that, you know, I'm afraid of being killed by the Israeli occupation, settlers or soldiers. They use anything possible to stop me and stop my group. They tried to buy me. They offered me money. They offered me a scholarship to leave Palestine and to live my life, you know, and to get, you know, permit and to get even VIP card, very important person card. They tried to buy me by giving me a higher privilege more than my people. I refused. Then they tried to scare me, to threaten me, arrest, detention. Didn't work. Then they started attacking my reputation, smear campaigns. Didn't work.
According to the Israeli NGO, B'Tselem, hundreds of Palestinian activists are held in Israeli prisons without any criminal charges. The vague legal process allows Israel to imprison Palestinians from the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip without charge or trial for an indefinite period of time. These arrests are based on undisclosed, secret evidence. As a prominent activist, Issa receives multiple death threats. In spite of this, he hasn't given up on the fight for his rights and those of his people.
I started doing advocacy and reaching mainstream media, and I was very successful in that thanks to the help of all the international and the local organizations who are helping the Palestinians, and thanks to the international activists who are doing amazing work to increase awareness about Palestine. My face is circled with red circle on the Israeli media website because of doing peaceful, non-violence resistance. So I wanted to talk to the international community that Palestinian non-violence resistance is there, but give us visibility, give us support, give us more resources to mobilize more Palestinians to use non-violence resistance against the Israeli occupation. I wanted the international community to understand my personal story and to understand that I am a human being who deserves full equality as everybody else in the world.
Today, while released on bail, Issa continues his non-violent crusade. He shares that while the international community remains silent about the injustices happening on the ground in Palestine, he hopes that things will change in the near future.
The Israeli government has, you know, virtually every day for 53 years been building settlements in the OPT. That's a war crime. It's a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention.
That's Omar again. Today, Israel disputes the applicability of the Fourth Geneva Convention to the occupied Palestinian territories. They argue that the West Bank and Gaza Strip are disputed, not occupied territories, and that their status can only be determined through negotiations. So, what gives you hope? What do you hope people take away from an understanding of Palestine and Israel, and what gives you hope for the future?
I think what gives me hope is the fact that every day there's a really dedicated group of human rights defenders on the ground, really innovative, creative, courageous people, Israelis and Palestinians that continue every day to document rights abuse, do their work. The resilience of communities on the ground, in particular Palestinians, have lived for decades and decades without basic rights. Although we're stuck in this ugly status quo that is decades long, I think there are cracks developing, there are brave people, there are narratives shifting globally, and it's going to be a fight. But the people who are in that fight and the communities on the ground that bear the brunt of the policies every day, meeting them, having gotten to know them so for the years that I was on the ground, gives me a lot of hope.
Thank you. Isa is among a growing number of Palestinians who have embraced nonviolent means of protesting Israel's military occupation and expanding settlements, and who are increasingly finding those avenues of dissent blocked. The right to freedom of expression is enshrined in Article 19 of the Universal Declaration for Human Rights, which sets out, in broad terms, the human rights that each of us has. It was later protected legally by a raft of international and regional treaties. Exercising these rights without fear or unlawful interference is central to living a life in an open and fair society, one in which people can access justice and enjoy their own human rights. Yet governments around the world routinely imprison people, or worse, for speaking out, even though, as Amnesty International notes, almost every country's constitution refers to the value of free speech. Silencing of nonviolence resistance is a global problem and requires collective action. Active citizenship is fundamental to building a just, peaceful, and prosperous society for all. To understand the importance of protecting people's rights to protest and advocate for their fundamental human rights, I speak with Hina Gilani in this special segment. Hina Gilani is a member of the Elders and is a pioneering lawyer and international champion for human rights.
I think it's absolutely critical to protect nonviolent resistance because this is an outlet that citizens do have to show their concerns about issues in terms of civil and political rights and social, economic, and cultural rights. If these avenues are blocked, the resistance can turn into chaos and disorder. And that is why certain standards have been set for peaceful protest, for peaceful assemblies, for the freedom of movement, for the use of freedom of expression. Even my example as a human rights defender in this country, and frequently subjected to repressive measures, I know that the reaction to repressive measures can lead to more disorder and chaos than a freedom to express the concerns that people have from time to time.
Hina Gilani says that it's an important right to be able to participate in your own government. And the best mechanism to demonstrate this ability is through freedom of assembly.
I think it's also important to mention that it is the obligation of the state to make sure that their actions in no way either restrict the right itself or ends up in any harm to the protesters. I have seen, as the special representative of the Secretary General on Human Rights Defenders, how many governments have violated the right of assembly of many peaceful protesters, and these peaceful assemblies have turned into chaos and disorder. I particularly mention this in regard to the whole concept of necessity and proportionality of the force used against protesters, where that necessity is very apparent. I have seen that in the protests of the Palestinian people in the West Bank and how the Israeli forces have reacted in a manner in which it is totally unacceptable to any notion or concept of proportionality. Young children throwing stones have been killed, where lethal weapons have been used against them. And I think these are some of the examples the world has to think about. These are not things that we can justify.
And how can the international community hold accountable those who violate the rights of citizens to protest?
I think accountability is one of the most important elements of the use of your freedoms in any country of the world. Very important in terms of the international standards laid down. It is also a part of the constitutional guarantees that every state gives to its people. When rights are violated, impunity is unacceptable. And therefore, accountability is really a part, very much a part of the guarantee for the exercise of the guaranteed and the protected rights. So human rights defenders in particular, as part of their right to defend human rights, they can monitor such protests, they can record what happened. And there are also international mechanisms which hold governments accountable for not taking care of their own obligations that are either obligations that they incur under their own constitutions and law or under the international treaties to which they are parties.
Here, Hina Gilani talks more about other mechanisms for international accountability, such as those established by the United Nations.
The UN Special Rapporteurs, especially the Special Rapporteur on the Freedom of Peaceful Assembly and the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Defenders, are continuously monitoring how governments are treating the right to peaceful assembly, the freedom of association, the freedom of speech and expression. These are mechanisms that are continuously monitoring state conduct, and then through their mechanisms, such as the Universal Periodical Review, exposing the failures of governments and asking them to remedy these gaps and these failures to uphold their own obligations. So these are some of the mechanisms that are important. And at the same time, I think it is important that civil societies in different parts of the world be given that space and that scope, not just to investigate and observe, but also to report where violations of the freedom of assemblies have occurred, where rights have been guaranteed in our constitution, the enforcement mechanism for these rights are courts, and accountability mechanisms to hold governments accountable at the national level are the national courts. And I think that's very important, that we are able to make sure that our judiciaries realize their role in making sure that rights are not only protected, but that those who violate rights are properly held accountable and that no impunity prevails.
As Margaret Mead famously said, quote, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed individuals can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has." It takes the masses standing up against oppression to challenge injustice. Through our podcast, we aim to educate and inspire you to take action on critical global issues. There are many ways to take action. Here are just a few suggestions. We understand that many human rights issues often seem confusing, convoluted, and politically charged. I encourage you to challenge yourself to look at human rights abuses through a non-biased lens and learn more about what's actually happening on the ground from diverse and opposing perspectives. Second, learn more about youth human rights and peacekeeping efforts in the West Bank and Gaza, and speak out against the detention and unfair punishment of advocates like Issa. And third, let your elected leaders know that you stand for peace, justice, and dignity of all people. You have the power to inspire real change. To learn more about this episode, check out the links to resources on our show notes and on our website, findinghumanitypodcast.com. Please subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you've enjoyed Finding Humanity, please share it and leave us a review. To learn more about topics in our podcast and other opportunities to engage with us, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at @find_humanity and on Facebook at Finding Humanity Podcast. In our podcast, we cover pressing and at times controversial social and political issues. The views and opinions expressed are those of the interviewees and do not reflect the positions or opinions of the producers or any affiliated organizations. Finding Humanity is a joint production of the Humanity Lab Foundation and Human Group Media. This season is made possible in part by our collaborating partner, The Elders. While this series is produced in collaboration with our partner, The Elders did not exercise any editorial discretion on this episode. Our executive producer is Camille Lorente. Associate producer is Fernanda Oriegas. Assistant producer is Diana Galbraith. Associate Production, Policy and Research by Martina Vanat, Aisha Amin, and Carolina Mendica. Mixing, Editing, and Music by Maverick Aquino. For this episode, I'd like to thank our experts, Omar Shakir, Avner Garyavu, and Hina Jilani. I'm your host, Hazami Bermada. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to seeing you on our next episode.